Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Monday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook. She invites you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts as we complete reading Samuel Hahnemann's Organon. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, taking a little time out in this day to begin with some inspiration to talk about some current events and read the words of Dr. Samuel Hahnemann in his Organon of Medicine. Today is February 7th, 2011. You're listening to show number 131. Thank you for joining me. I would like to remind everyone that this is a simple study session and any listeners must consult their healthcare provider. If you are on the live chat, I do ask you to introduce yourself to each other. Post your comments and questions there. You can click Listen, Friend, Favorite on the Blog Talk Radio website. You can share this with your friends via Twitter, Facebook. You can even put it up to the other, stumble upon and dig in the other websites to let people know about the show. You can even listen to the old shows and download them to your computer, your iTunes or iPod. If you're a professional homeopath and have colleagues in the homeopathy world community, you can invite them and be invited by your friend and join. The Vaccinations and Your Rights show the last week had 264 downloads. This is a great number for us to hear that people are listening. Since May of 2010, we've now had upwards of 15,000 listens, over 15,000, and we're reaching now 2,000 downloads per month. So do get on to Twitter and follow us there and get the news. We have so much excitement in the current events today. On our daily homeopaths online newspaper, it's the http://Debbie Brook/homeopaths, or you can get it on bit.ly/homeopathsdaily. And there are incredible numbers of great articles going on today. We've got vitamin B12 protects the heart, mind, eyes, and more. We've got research finds adaptogens reduce stress, and many others by Healthy Living. So get on there and look at those. And there's actually a whole page of those great articles on general health. And then we also have all the ones having to do with our homeopathic society. And Heidi Stevenson has put up a brand new article on the Gaia Health website, the UK moves to cripple homeopathy and eliminate non-allopathic homeopaths. And I am hoping that in the future we'll have a great radio session with her and learn more about this particular issue that we're dealing with in the policies and politics today in Europe and around the world. There's also information about Luc Montagnier and how homeopathy should be taken seriously. We've got a lot of videos also on the Homeopaths Daily and a special article by Susan Humphreys, MD, who has written a specific article about the vaccination issue and her stand on that. So do take a look at the Homeopaths Daily, and I'm sure you'll find it on the internet. What else is in the news? Most profound story is one that was written by Joette Calabrese on Natural Parenting Center, A Better World Begins at Home. And she did an interview with that organization, Empowering Mothers with Homeopathy and Nutrition. It's a fantastic article. I'll read a little excerpt of it. She says, but the most profound story is the one about my Aunt Mary. This is her aunt that she had been in touch with weekly and had always given her homeopathic remedies to cure her ills. And one time, and she says, unfortunately, this one is not bestowed with a happy ending. Aunt Mary was my godmother, with whom I was very close. We spoke on the phone weekly. Years ago, I had given her a homeopathic kit so she could call me should she need my help. Well, one night she slipped and sprained her ankle. Normally, she would have called me to get a remedy, but this time she just went to the doctor without phoning because she knew I had a busy week. I would have indeed recommended that she have her ankle looked at to be certain it wasn't a break, and then a homeopathic remedy for the pain, swelling, and quick healing. And you're going to have to read the rest of this. Let's see. Instead, on the way home, my uncle stopped at a drugstore to get Darvon. Following the doctor's instruction, that night she took the Darvon, and within 6 hours, she died in her bed. The cause of death was cardiac arrest. However, no one in my aunt's very large family had ever had heart issues, and only weeks prior she had given a clean bill of health from the very doctor who prescribed the Darvon. Down to my toes, I knew it was the Darvon. So did my mother and my uncle. When I reviewed the dangers of the drug online, it was logical that the drug had caused her death. Now, 2 years later, class action suits are sprouting everywhere against the manufacturer. The FDA has finally banned Darvon and Darvocet. Just for the record, it's been prescribed since 1957. The reason it was taken off the market? It causes cardiac abnormalities and arrest in people who don't have a history of heart disease, even in recommended doses. How many unsuspecting folks have been poisoned by this drug in the last 40 years with the cause of death appearing to be something else? This is really fascinating information, and we must take note of it. We must let other people know that they need to check online what are the side effects of the drugs that they are taking. More than 10,000 people a year may die from the side effects of medicines prescribed by their doctors, and most of those deaths are unnecessary, says a study that was published in 2004. That's some time ago. The study published in the British Medical Journal finds that 1 in 16 of all admissions to hospital is caused by the side effects of a drug. The cost to the National Health Society of the UK of the most avoidable treatments of the patients is estimated at £466 million a year. The researchers investigated the reasons why 18,820 patients were admitted to two hospitals in Merseyside during the six-month period. They found that 1,225 were suffering from an adverse drug reaction, that's an ADR. Most patients recovered, but 28 died. And you can read more about that on theguardian.co.uk. The authors were Munir Pir Mohammed, professor of clinical pharmacology at Liverpool University. And the colleagues, they say that their figures suggest that drug side effects cause the deaths of about 5,700 patients. So that is what's going on for pharmaceuticals today. We have some inspirational quotes, as always, come from Iman Nawab on our Facebook. I don't have it at the tip of my finger, so you're going to have to go there and look. Instead, we're going to talk a little bit about homeopathic medicines and just give it like a little introduction for those people who haven't been listening to the show since May 2010 when we started. Homeopathy is a viable system of medicine, a successful system of medicine, that was founded in the early 19th century by a German physician, Dr. Samuel Hahnemann. And that's why we're reading his Organon of Medicine. It has its greatest popularity in the late 19th century, even here in the United States, where I'm calling from, when 15% of the doctors in this country were homeopaths. However, with the advent of modern medicine, antibiotics, and a mechanistic perspective of the human body into diverse parts, which split the medical model into specialists, it takes concerned and aware physicians a concerted effort to create teams today of doctors to discuss just one patient, because it is like they do not know what the head is saying to the foot. I do believe in this decade they have begun to take a closer look at what they where and when and how they turned off this path to healing and were led down this road to a more complex system based upon a lifetime of drugs and disease management rather than true healing. Since the 1980s, homeopathy has emerged again with a resurgence by physicians and the complementary and alternative healers, that's the CAM, CAM people, who are looking for a better way both in the United States, in the UK, and around the world. Homeopathy has been firmly established in other countries like Cuba, Brazil, Malaysia, Germany, France, and even parts of the part of the government medical system in India and other Asian countries. Bookstores have shelves of dedicated areas to homeopathy and natural healing. Remedies can be found in all of the natural health food stores and even today in your regular drugstores and pharmacies. What people need to understand are the tenets of classical homeopathy. You may count on them on one hand or just three fingers. First, the law of similars. Second, the single medicine. And the third, the minimum dose. And I'm just going to check in the chat room if there's any comments or questions as we're going through this, just in case anyone has any questions. Checking on the HWC. And we have a few people who are here, and we'll just continue on today with these three tenets of classical homeopathy. The law of similars states that a disease is cured by a medicine which creates symptoms similar to those the patient is experiencing in a healthy person. We've been discussing this principle since May of 2010, and this means that the homeopath must have a thorough knowledge of the substance's medicinal effects, how it can change an individual's normal state of being to a disordered state through careful observation, documentation, and recording of symptoms in these provings. A homeopath can understand similarly to what we do in a clinical trial by understanding what the medicinal actions of that substance are in a healthy human being. Not only does the homeopath understand the potential for that medicine to cause and cure symptoms, he or she must recognize the patient's state of health and the changes to sickness. Thus, it is important for taking the case, careful listening to the person to describe the mental, emotional, physical, and even spiritual feelings and sensations. The homeopath can also gather information about the patient from friends and relatives. And if the patient is an infant, then the caretaker can tell what is happening, and the physician can make observations from the behavior in that baby, the interactions that the infant has, and use all of the homeopath's five senses to learn about that patient. So the sense of smell, touch, sound, hearing, using the eyes to observe what gestures the baby is performing. All of these things are important to understand what remedy is going to be the best selection. The second principle, the giving of only one single remedy at a time, is most scientific in nature. This way, the homeopath may determine the action of the remedy upon the individual, assess what is happening to the individual in the case, and to judge and manage the progress of this case. With allopathic drugs, which are composed of many synthetics and the taking of many pills at the same time, this can cause a disturbance in the person's total health. But there is little way to actually judge what makes the person better or worse. It's just too complicated. Since allopathy does not bring mind and body together, they might give a drug for a headache and another drug for a stomach ache, instead of recognizing the connection between them through a medicinal agent. Instead, they call these discrepancies side effects. Okay, so we're going to give you a drug for this problem, and you're going to end up with that problem, not realizing that it is the substance itself, the drug itself, that is causing these effects in the totality and the holistic perspective of what's going on with that human being. The third principle under discussion is the minimum dose. We will be discussing this further in today's program. Just to suffice it to say, it is the smallest quantity that will affect and catalyze a healing response. We have described how if one dose is given, that it may be enough, but the physician will wait and see to determine whether any more of the medicinal agent is needed. That would be called a repetition of the dose. I see that Marilyn has come to visit us. Okay, Marilyn, how are you?
Hi, Debbie. Sorry I'm late. No, I have a house emergency. It's snowing outside and it's raining in my house.
Oh, my gosh.
It's leaking, so I had to, put a pail under it and everything, and so that's why I'm late.
Oh, no problem at all. As a matter of fact, here in North Carolina, the sun is shining so brightly, I'm just ready to go out for a walk and take in the sunshine. But we are discussing the three principles that guides the homeopath to select and choose how they give a homeopathic remedy to a person who is suffering. And we're right now talking about the minimum dose and moving on to the fact that the homeopathic medicines are given in infinitesimal doses, and that irks many of the so-called scientists, researchers, physicians, and skeptics. However, over the course of centuries, homeopaths have discovered that the effect of homeopathic medicines is actually strengthened upon successive dilutions as long as the medicine is violently shaken or succussed between each dilution. Medicines are typically used in very high dilutions, such as a 30C or a 200C. Many claim the positive response to homeopathic remedies are due to the placebo effect, but this does not pan out. When homeopathic remedies work at a cellular level on crops, fruit trees, plants, also on pets and farm animals, we have lots of data that corroborates that they're even recommending to use these remedies for farm animals, like for cows and cattle who have mastitis, instead of drugs. It actually works better. When a beneficial effect produced by a placebo drug or treatment cannot be attributed to the properties of the placebo itself, scientists say it must be due to the patient's belief in that type of treatment. And that is kind of the definition of placebo effect. The problem, as earlier stated, is that the plants and the animals, they don't have a belief system in any treatment types. They respond by instinct and would not know that they were undergoing treatment. There are numerous controlled studies that have been performed which show the effectiveness of homeopathic medicine in treating a number of diseases. There are lots of summaries that you can find on the internet, and we can give you links to those. Okay.
There's a great link, okay, which you told me about.
Okay, what is that?
Which actually talks about the technology that shows how homeopathic medicine works.
Okay.
And that's the extraordinarymedicine.org.
Excellent.
Right? I'm just trying to find it.
Okay. They just look up extraordinary medicine. It will pop
dot
up on
.org.
The internet.
It's been put together by different groups, homeopathic groups. And they actually talk about the mechanism of action. They talk about frequent false statements about homeopathy and the truth. They have high dilution studies. And homeopathy's best research, the extraordinary evidence homeopathy's enemies and their media allies don't want you to see. So there's a lot of great information that shows how homeopathy works and what it's all about.
That's true. And they're constantly trying to attack homeopathy, but it has been used by notables, including the British royal family since 1918, Nobel laureates, scientists, and even Charles Darwin, and he was a skeptic.
Well, Dana Ullman wrote a book.
Yes.
Do you remember the title of it?
Revolution.
Yes.
That one?
Yeah, all about who has used homeopathy throughout the ages. And we find that homeopathy was used by Hippocrates. It was used, evidence of it, as early as about 3000 BC. There's evidence of its use in the Bible. Do you want me to tell you specifically just one place where it's been used?
In the Bible?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we know it's been used in the Bible. I wanted to give
you... it's been used in the Bible. Okay.
Dane Ullman's book is called Homeopathy Revolution.
Yeah.
And he has... lots and lots of chapters about all the people in every walk of life, from literary personalities to scientists to actresses and actors and people who are physicians all around the world and academics, all sorts of people use it, musicians, and even Mother Teresa. So I do recommend you getting that book.
Yeah, Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin also used it. Mark Twain.
Yeah, and these people were not dummies. So homeopathy has been recognized by the UN, the World Health Organization, as the second most used healing modality in the world.
It's also the fastest growing modality in the world.
Awesome. That's great. And it has a much greater rate of success and safety than the toxic drug model. And so that's why they're trying to get on top of this, because it's... the medical model, which is failing, is looking for a scapegoat, and homeopathy seems to be it. So we're going to continue on with the three. Did we cover all three of those? I think we covered all three of the principles now, which were the law of similars, the single medicine, and the minimum dose, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And there's another great thing. I'll let you go ahead with this if you have information about the fact that Dr. Samuel Hahnemann, 1755 to 1843, was well ahead of his time when he developed homeopathy. And we could just give you a little tidbits, pieces of Trivial Pursuit about what he did that was way ahead of his time. Like in 1792, he advocated for the healthy accommodation for the sick. These are great bits of information from the HMC21.org website. I recommend you visiting that website as well. And his view was not taken up widely until Florence Nightingale produced evidence confirming its importance in 1854. So from 1792 to 1854, it just began to get recognized.
You know, he went into the institutions and people who were, you know, had psychological problems, psychiatric problems, they were treated as though they were criminals. They lived in you know, very poor conditions, and they were totally ignored and behind bars. And he went in there and said, these people have to go for walks. They have to see the outside. They have to be outdoors. They have to be treated humanely and kindly, and, you know, treated them totally different and actually helped change the way that these people were treated in all the institutions that they were put away in and forgotten about. And it was a totally different treatment than had been experienced. So it was very revolutionary for that area of medicine.
That's absolutely true. And even today, because homeopathy works on the levels of the mind, emotions, and the physical ailments, we can address with these homeopathic remedies persons who you might consider to be hysterical, to be emotionally distraught, to be insane, to be without any method of healing, and to enable them to cope and become a functioning person in society. And this is the beauty of homeopathy. So we need to take a look at it and use it more in these kinds of areas, in the area of psychology. In 1795, he advocated for improvements in public hygiene measures, as you were saying, such as the improvements only appeared toward the end of the 19th century and were a major reason for the reduction in mortality rates before 1914. So just sanitation itself, in sanitation in hospitals and cleanliness in the environment, in your home, in the public utilities, just all of these things take an important part in improving health. And he advocated for that.
And he actually, in the Organon, I'm trying to find it as you're talking, he talks about, you know, somebody who's living in, you know, a cellar, right, in damp conditions. How
right.
can you expect them to get well? So that, again, is part of, you know, the improvements in public hygiene.
Correct. And he would consider these kinds of things obstacles to cure, that even if you were giving drugs or medication or homeopathic remedies to a person who was maintaining those causations, the etiologies, whatever it is that's causing the person to continue to be sick, if the little kid keeps eating the lead paint off the walls, they're just going to continue to be sick. So this is something that we need to clean up our environment. In 1809, he was publicly opposed to the common treatment of bloodletting, and a justification published later shows that his reasons are the same as they are given today, which means that things have really not changed that much in 200 years. His common sense, logic, observation, understanding of nature is still solid ground and a foundation in reasoning for the way that we do homeopathy today. That does not change. When something is universal law, it does not change. We don't change every day or every month, have a recall on anything. That's not part of homeopathy. Hahnemann was the first to employ the scientific method to develop a medical system. He employed a combination of detailed research of past and contemporaneous medical records and toxicological reports, observation, experiment, theory, and construction. His arguments about the relationship of treatment to illness were supported by references to the work and observation of others. So it's not just him doing this all alone. This is a collaborative effort. This is like one of those research studies. I forget the word that they use when they collect the data all over, and they do a report from that collected data.
Research?
Oh, there's a special word for it. It's a special kind of study, not new study, but it's a review of all the old work and what has already been recorded. And so this is something that he looked into. So by looking at toxicological reports, he's looking at persons who had been in the past been diseased or had been poisoned by some substance, and then he could categorize that information and collect that information, make it more solid to what he understood through his observations and theory. Homeopathy was the first medical system to conduct scientific trials of medicine before using them to treat the sick. So you don't just go out there and do a mass guinea pig experiment and give vaccinations that have not ever been tested or tried in a large public to create some massive amount of data to understand and know that you're not going to harm anyone. Before he ever did that, he always tested on healthy individuals in the minimum dose so that it would not cause any harm. So that was the scientific method that we've been studying all along in the Organon of Medicine, his how-to book.
Right. Still how we do, and that's still how we get new medicines in our Materia Medica. We still do the same thing. We do provings, which are done on healthy people. Right? We don't do it on sick people.
Exactly. So we're observers of nature. And then we can apply what we've learned. And by 1831, homeopathy had become the first medical system to adopt the concept of microorganisms in its explanation of health and disease, some 60 years before Koch saw them through his microscope. So if you understand, if you know, can make it a hypothesis based on observation, you know that there's something there before you even see it, just like Pluto. Just like a planet that the astronomers can know that something is there in the universe based on mathematical calculations based on their observations of energy and forces in nature. And he was able to do that with health and disease. Homeopathy was the first medical system to recognize that those organisms could evolve. Some 30 years before Darwin published on the origin of the species. Now, isn't that news? We're talking about, I've got tons of articles about the mutation of viruses and bacteria. And here, way back there in 1755, he had already recognized this. By 1840,
he also recognized that there was, you know, tied with that is our genetic predisposition. Because those microorganisms, whether they were bacterial or viral or disease of some sort, had a genetic base as well.
Can you repeat that?
Mind you, that's not in the Organon. The theory of miasms is not in the Organon. But if we're talking about, you know, the fact that the concept of microorganisms, right, that is part of the genetics of what we are predisposed to.
Well, I think that I'm not exactly clear, but I think that miasms is really more of the vital force. So it's a spiritual entity. It's even beyond the microorganism themselves. Those in the medical model, we might say the germ theory and say that microorganisms are the cause, but that is not what we as homeopaths believe. We understand that microorganisms are living in a symbiotic relationship in harmony with the body, and therefore, in order for them to survive, they will mutate, and they will do it faster and quicker and more powerfully than humans can, because we grow very slowly, but they multiply very quickly.
Very quickly.
So, right. So miasms, I believe, is a much higher level of understanding. It's more that vital force of how our energy is in the world. By 1841, Hahnemann had identified the need for healthy housing and a healthy diet, including avoidance of excess use of sugar and salt. This has become an important issue today. He was way ahead of his time, talking about nutrition and diet and abuse of spices, and it's written all in Organon.
What about coffee? Coffee was a big one as well.
Coffee and tea and all of these, let's say, caffeine and chocolate. And we do have excesses today, and our bodies react in certain ways, so some more sensitive than others. But we do have cravings, and we understand that, and we know that sugar plays a part with insulin and diabetics, and salt with heart disease. So there's all of these correspondences of what we eat influences who we are, and Hahnemann knew that way back when. By 1827, Hahnemann recognized that it was insufficient to look on matter as dead mass, for from its interior can be elicited incredible and hitherto unsuspected powers. That's a quote. The extent of such powers is still being investigated by physicists. The field of homeopathy has continued to develop and expand for over 200 years, both clinically and theoretically. Knowledge acquired in the past continues to be valid today, but it is becoming better understood and more thoroughly explored. This is exactly the process one would expect in a scientific field. So that is, these are some of the points that we've been reading on the HMC21 website, and we can expound on them, so that homeopathy is truly scientific. It incorporates all fields of medicine, biology, physics, chemistry. It's all in one. It's holistic. It looks at the total human being. It includes psychology and exercise and nutrition. We are looking and observing everything in the environment of the individual that could affect them. The fact that homeopathy is at the forefront of medicine is shown by another curious fact. All the arguments used against homeopathy were also used in Hahnemann's lifetime. As he responded to those attacks, if no new arguments have appeared in more than 160 years, it shows that homeopathy does not conflict with any of the scientific advances during that time. Indeed, modern knowledge of physics, microorganisms, drug actions, even genetics, and homeostasis actually tend to confirm homeopathic theory. So there's nothing new under the sun. We're all just repeating ourselves, but we should be repeating the truth, which is what Hahnemann has written in his Organon of Medicine. And let's take a look at how much time we have today. We're going to talk about the Organon specifically. Do you have any comment on all of that from HMC 21, those points of the historical sequence of Hahnemann and how it relates to science today?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Do you have any comments?
Yeah.
No, I think we covered everything very nicely.
Great. Okay. We're going to pick up where we left off by reviewing the aphorisms, because we do want to talk about the Organon. And we're already up to aphorism number 161, but we're going to backtrack a little bit. Aphorism number 160, do you happen to have it in front of you?
You know what? I have 161 in front of you. 161. Hold on, 160. So we did this last week, but as the dose of a homeopathic remedy can scarcely ever be made so small that it shall not be able to relieve, overpower, indeed completely cure, and annihilate the uncomplicated natural disease of not long-standing that is analogous to it, and there's aphorism 249, the note to it, we can understand why a dose of an appropriate homeopathic medicine, not the very smallest possible, does always, during the first hour after its ingestion, produce a perceptible homeopathic aggravation of this kind.
Okay. And what we're going to do is just kind of put it into our own words so that we get a feel for this.
So I think that what we could say is that it creates this primary...
I'm losing your sound.
Oh,
Marilyn, are you there?
Can you not hear me?
Speak up next to the microphone.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So what we were talking about last week with regard to this aphorism is that it's a medicinal kind of an aggravation that we're feeling. It's the medicine is creating the symptoms. And it is not the symptoms of the disease of the person that is being felt, but this aggravation which is produced by the medicine if it is a little, if it's a little bit too strong a dose, or if it's not exactly the similimum. Right?
Okay. Right. Because we were talking about that triangle and that if you can put three equal angles and three equal sides of the triangle, one on top of the other, it would be a perfect match. But we don't always have a remedy that is a perfect match. So sometimes if those two do not match each other exactly, then we're going to have something called some extra symptoms. It's not the aggravation. So what he's saying here is that the smallest dose that you can give will indeed completely cure and annihilate an uncomplicated natural disease. That's an acute disease, something that hasn't been there for very long. We can understand why a dose of an appropriate homeopathic medicine does always during the first hour. So he's giving us a time sequence that we're going to have an aggravation. So that aggravation means that it is, an aggravation is talking about symptoms that the patient actually is experiencing from the natural disease that will be aggravated. So we will see possibly an intensity, the person is able to deal and cope with that intensity on a spiritual, emotional, mental, and even a physical level because it's just a short-acting aggravation.
Right.
So that's when it's most similar.
And we should note that it's like usually for, you know, it usually passes after about an hour or so. Right?
Yes, it doesn't linger. And then we're going to go ahead on with Aphorism 161. Do you want to read that one?
Okay, let me see where it is. When I hear limit...
You seem to have disappeared in your sound
when
again.
When I hear limit...
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
When I hear limit, the so-called homeopathic aggravation... or rather the primary action of the homeopathic medicine that seems to increase somewhat the symptoms of the original disease to the first or few first hours, this is certainly true with respect to diseases of a more acute character and of recent origin. But where medicines of long action have to combat a malady of considerable or very long standing, where no such apparent increase of the original disease ought to appear during treatment, and it does not so appear if the accurately chosen medicine was given in proper small, gradually higher doses, each somewhat modified with renewed dynamization, such increase of the original symptoms of a chronic disease can appear only at the end of treatment when the cure is almost or quite finished.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to describe that a little bit?
Well, what I understand from it is that if we're going to give the remedy for chronic conditions, long-standing chronic conditions, there shouldn't appear any of the symptoms. There shouldn't be any kind of aggravation at all. And that, you know, we gradually give the remedy in a higher dose, right, through succussion, through those kinds of, what's the word, it's on the tip of my tongue. We're going to succuss the remedy. We're going to raise the potency and everything very, very, very slowly. At the end of the treatment, that's when the patient may experience what we would say would be an aggravation of,
right,
the symptoms
and that's
of
indication.
Their disease.
Right, and that's an indication that the end of the person is now in a state of being cured.
Right.
Usually. This is something that has been observed and noted by him and other homeopaths as the action toward cure. So I'm just going to review this a little bit more. When I hear limit the so-called homeopathic aggravation, the primary action of the homeopathic medicine that seems to increase somewhat the symptoms of the original disease, this is what we've just been speaking about, that aggravation is the primary action of the medicine, the artificial disease to the matches the individual, and it seems to increase the symptoms of the original disease for those first few hours. This is true with respect to diseases of a more acute character. So we're talking about acute injury like for emergency medicine. But where medicines of long action have to combat a malady of considerable long-standing, which is chronic disease, where no such apparent increase in the original disease ought to appear. So he's saying that you're not expecting to see an increase of the disease during the treatment. And it does not so appear if the accurately chosen medicine was given in a proper, small, gradually higher doses. So he's giving instructions here that, number one, it's got to be the semilimum. It's got to be given in the smallest dose. And it's going to be given in repetitions that are never the same, but are in increasingly gradually higher potencies or higher doses, each one somewhat modified with the dynamization or the succussion. So he's giving us these instructions. And this follows true to form what we were speaking about in the beginning of today's study session. I think that your sound is just gone today, Marilyn.
Do you really can't hear me at all, eh?
Well, I can if you either get closer to your mic or speak up louder.
Okay, I'm going to speak loud. I thought I was speaking loud.
No, you're going to have. No, you're doing a little bit better now. Okay, so such increase of the original symptoms of a chronic disease can appear only at the end of treatment when the cure is almost or quite finished. And that was what we just stated. Would you mind going ahead with aphorism number 162?
I have it in front of me. It sometimes happens, owing to the moderate number of medicines yet known with respect to their true pure action, that but a portion of the symptoms of the disease under treatment is to be met with in the list of symptoms of the most appropriate medicine. Consequently, this imperfect medicinal morbific agent must be employed for lack of a more perfect one.
Okay, so this is during his time, his day and age, when they were just starting the provings and gathering data and creating their toolbox, their remedy kit. They had a limited number of remedies, and a lot of them were what we call polycress, which means that they cover a large number of symptoms, which means that they would cover a large number of diseases or sufferings in the individual, whether it was for headaches or diarrhea or indigestion or aches and pains, sprains, whatever it was, it covered a large number of symptoms. And therefore, they didn't have the information about the number of remedies that we have today that might be a more perfect fit for an individual. So what did he have to do?
Hahnemann had, 100 remedies that he worked with. And we have something like, the figure varies, but it's between 3,500 and 4,000 remedies today in our Materia Medica.
We've become very complicated human beings.
And there's still provings going on, and people saying that we don't have enough remedies, that we need to expand our repertoire of remedies. Can you imagine what Hahnemann would think?
That's because we're perfectionists. We like to get it exactly spot on.
Yeah.
And probably the people in his day and age were much hardier. They didn't have to deal with the kinds of insults that we have in our polluted environment and the number of drugs and everything that's going on today. So probably the actions of his medicines worked very well for him, but still he wanted to indicate and let us know as homeopaths that the medicines yet known with respect to their true pure action, that but a portion of the symptoms of the disease under treatment is to be met with in the list of symptoms of the most appropriate medicine. So therefore, consequently, he says, this imperfect, there's that word imperfect and perfection, medicinal morbific agent must be employed for the lack of a more perfect one. So he was striving and searching for more information. For instance, we have remedies of plants, we have remedies of animals, and some people would say that even to take a particular part of an animal, whether it's the blood or the bones or the nail
or the feather.
Or the feather, whatever, a particular part of the animal will be a closer energetic resonance to an individual. Even though healing will occur with one part of that animal taken into a potency and succussed and given to the individual as their catalyst to healing, but to get the exact spot on part of that remedy, or even I've heard, you know, let's say you give lacoquinum, a horse, to somebody, but there are homeopaths who say a specific type of horse, a wild horse or a thoroughbred, might be even a better match for certain persons. So we have a lot to learn. It's a never-ending journey. Aphorism number
163. Want me to read it?
Please do.
In this case, we cannot indeed expect from this medicine a complete, undisturbed cure, for during its use, some symptoms appear which were not previously observable in the disease. Accessory symptoms of the not perfectly appropriate remedy. This does by no means prevent a considerable part of the disease, which is the symptoms of the disease that resemble those of the medicine, from being eradicated by this medicine, thereby establishing a fair commencement of the cure. But still, this does not take place without those accessory symptoms, which are, however, always moderate when the dose of the medicine is sufficiently minute.
So here he's emphasizing that we need to keep to that smallest dose and to expect that when you don't have a perfect match, the perfectly appropriate remedy, there will be some of these extra symptoms, accessory symptoms that will take place.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
In this case, so he says, we cannot expect from this medicine, which is not perfect, a complete undisturbed cure. So he's saying if you have a perfect match, a perfect similimum, you're going to have a complete and undisturbed cure. I mean, it's you're not going to feel any of these types of aggravations. For during its use, some symptoms appear which were not previously observable in the disease. Accessory symptoms of the not perfectly appropriate remedy. So it's symptoms of the remedy, not symptoms of the disease.
Right, right.
Right, in the individual. I wanted to let people know that we have great supporters on Homeopathy World Community that really keeps us going and motivates us. And one of those people is Roger Van, help me with his name, Zandvoort, who is, and Edwin, who are the founders and creators of the Complete Dynamics in Homeopathy. They set a new standard in homeopathy with the complete repertory that you can download actually for free on your computer. You can get it at www.completedynamics.com. So that means that every homeopath can have a complete repertory on his computer absolutely free. It's available both, or three, for Mac, OS, Windows, and Linux. I don't know how you pronounce that, Linux or Linux?
Yeah, I think it's Linux.
And it's really a fantastic program. I use it daily. I look everything up on there. And there is a practitioner edition that contains additional perks, case management, analysis, and materia medica. It's really, really worth it. It's Roger Van Zandvoort, and he has dedicated his life to creating the best homeopathic repertory in the world, so he says, and Edwin Van Grinspen, who has a professional background in software development for 25 years, and he also runs a private practice in homeopathy since 1998. Let us go ahead with aphorism number 194, are we up to?
164.
What? 164?
Yeah, you only skipped 30 aphorisms.
Oh, I'm just dyslexic and turning my numbers around. Okay. Go ahead with this one. And
the small number of homeopathic symptoms present in the best selected medicine is no obstacle to the cure in cases where, now this is in capital letters, where these few medicinal symptoms are chiefly of an uncommon kind and such are peculiarly distinctive, characteristic of the disease. The cure takes place under such circumstance without any particular disturbance. We as homeopaths have the ability to make, that's something different.
That's our discussion.
That's our discussion from yesterday.
Yeah, we were talking about this aphorism 164, that we do have the ability to do something that allopaths don't have. And that is, as we observe the medicinal action on the individual who's suffering and we see what is happening in the progress of the illness, that we can make adjustments to the dose. And the allopaths can't do that. I mean, they just give a crude drug, and until the body gets rid of it, they're going to get these side effects. You know, sometimes they have to have their stomach pumped or something to get a drug out of them. So with homeopathy, we can fine-tune everything while we're observing the management of this individual, and we can do it on many levels with the quantity, the frequency, the how much succussion, and the potency.
Debbie?
And, yes.
We missed one. I just thought of it now. We have the ability to antidote.
Oh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
That goes together. So that's got to be, you know, point number five. We can also antidote making adjustments.
Yes, you can antidote if it is not the precise similimum. If it's the precise similimum, you're just going to, can't do anything about that. You're just going to go straight to cure. So we have about 2 minutes left. So let's explain this a little bit more for the listeners, that we can make these adjustments when we provide the remedy to the individual by the quantity. So are you going to take a whole glass of the diluted substance? Are you going to take just a teaspoon? Remember, Hahnemann always says, give the minimum, the minimal dose. And or are you going to take one pellet dry under your tongue? So you always want to take the smallest quantity that will initiate this healing primary action. The second thing is the frequency. How often will you give it? Hahnemann has said in the past, just give it once. Once, wait and see. Only if you need it again, based on observation, do you repeat it. The third thing is, how much do you succuss if you're giving a liquid dose? Do you succuss, do you tap your glass a number of times, your bottle? Do you stir it vigorously? Or do you, how much of a energetic stimulation and vibration do you give to that remedy each time you give it? That's another way to adjust your dose. And finally, we have the potency. So do we give a low potency, 6C, 12C, 30C, a medium to high, 200C, or a 1M? These are all ways that we can fine-tune. We're at 90 seconds, so we're really out of time. Thank you for joining me. And we've covered a lot of ground today. And we will see you the next time, which will be next Monday, for Who's Reading the Organon? Homeopathy World Community. I want to thank everyone for listening today. It was a great show. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Debbie. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon with host Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to take your Organon off the shelf and read it.